welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show where we talk about how science intersects with our cultural creations, from art and music to film and dance to TV. Speaking of which, Beth Ann Ackerley is the TV columnist at New Scientist, which means she watches a lot of TV, including science fiction. And she, like many of us space enthusiasts at New Scientist, has been following a particular alternate history show with rapt attention.
Some of the best sci-fi I've watched recently is For All Mankind. For those who don't know, For All Mankind is a series on Apple TV Plus that explores what might have happened if the space race between America and the USSR had heated up in the 1970s rather than cooling down. It's just aired its fourth season, which was all about a settlement on Mars, and it got us thinking about the future of Mars exploration in our own universe. Now, settling on Mars might seem a long way away to us now. We've sent probes to orbit the planet and rovers to explore it, but none have returned and humans are yet to set foot there. But we've been researching Mars's geology and habitability for decades, and over the past 60-odd years, we've built a foundation of knowledge that could one day lead to crewed missions and even permanent bases on the planet. Upcoming Mars missions include the Rosalind Franklin rover, which is part of the European Space Agency's ExoMars program, and is due to land on Mars in the late 2020s. But there are huge challenges we need to overcome if we're ever to build a permanent outpost there. The freezing temperatures, the dust storms, the radiation, the lack of food, Mars quakes, the list goes on. So is there reason to hope that we might one day build settlements on Mars? And should we be hoping for that at all? To find out more about the future of Mars exploration, we have two amazing guests for you. First, we have astronaut Garrett Reisman, who's spent 107 days in space aboard the International Space Station. He now wears many hats. He's a consultant at SpaceX, a professor of aeronautics practice at the University of Southern California, and a public speaker, as well as a scientific advisor to For All Mankind. Garrett, thank you for joining us.
Oh, very happy to be here.
Our second guest is planetary scientist Tanya Harrison, who is an expert in all things Mars. Co-founder of the Earth and Planetary Institute of Canada and a fellow of the Outer Space Institute, she has worked as a mission specialist and a scientist on multiple NASA missions to Mars. Tanya, hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, first off, what do you both think about the prospect of one day building off-world outposts, you know, whether that's on Mars or on the moon or, you know, even further afield than that?
Well, if you take the kind of big picture view, I think there's cause for a lot of optimism about our future as a species, and then there's cause for pessimism. And I think every day when I check the news, I get my fill of the pessimism about where we're heading. But if we manage to work out our differences and coexist peacefully, I think it's inevitable that we one day spread out throughout the solar system. And I think there are certainly a lot of challenges, and I'm sure we'll talk about those. But I'm optimistic that we'll have that future that I want for my children, which is kind of the Star Trek, peaceful coexistence future, where we do go out and explore and settle throughout the solar system. I think that's our destiny, as long as we don't screw it up.
I completely agree. The listeners can't see this, but I'm wearing a Star Trek hoodie as we do this interview. So I'm definitely a fan.
And it's amazing.
Thanks. I'm definitely a fan of the Star Trek future for humanity. I think there's so much to explore out there. And the robots that we send are great. Satellites and rovers do amazing things, but they're not a replacement for humans. And so not only is it exciting just to be able to think about sending humans beyond the Earth, but to answer a lot of those fundamental questions that we want to answer, like, is there life on Mars? Is there life in the ocean of Europa? Are there aliens beyond our solar system? I think we're really going to need humans to be able to do that. And so going off Earth is really the best way for us to keep exploring.
So Tanya, you touched on the kind of rovers and probes that we have sent to Mars. What have those previous Mars missions taught us about the planet so far?
So we've learned that Mars about 3.5 billion years ago was very similar to the Earth. It was much warmer. It was a lot wetter. There were rivers. There were lakes inside craters. Both Curiosity and Perseverance right now, the two rovers that NASA has that are still working, are exploring former crater lakes on Mars. And we know that the water, when it was there, had all the right conditions for life as we know it to thrive. You know, the right pH and the right chemical ingredients and all that sort of thing. So we've managed to put together this picture of ancient Mars, this place that could have possibly been inhabitable if there was life there, but we haven't definitively answered the question of whether or not life was there in the past. And then we've been taking data of Mars for decades at this point, both from ground-based telescopes at the Earth and satellites and rovers on Mars that tell us what Mars is like today. We know it's this arid polar desert, so very dry but cold, like some places in Antarctica. We know that it has really active weather patterns. You mentioned dust storms in the introduction. Those are a serious problem. We lost the Opportunity rover thanks to a dust storm, for example. So it's a really dynamic place today. And each mission that we've sent has kind of filled in some of the gaps as to our understanding of how dynamic of a place Mars is compared to what we knew maybe in the 1970s from just Mariner and Viking. We knew Mars had weather, but we didn't know how much other things were happening, like these Mars quakes and other little bits of geologic activity that we've seen here and there, like avalanches and maybe these little bits of flowing liquid water on the surface of Mars today. So it's a really exciting place. And each mission we send just tells us more information while also giving us more questions that need to be answered.
So there are people who think, you know, spending billions of dollars on any kind of space project, let alone, you know, for the purposes of one day building an outpost somewhere, is a bit of a waste of money. I was just wondering what the two of you thought about that and what you would say to someone who viewed it as such.
Well, I think it's a matter of proportions. If we were spending double digit percentages of our GDPs on space exploration, I would agree that we would be neglecting very pressing problems here on Earth that need to be addressed, but we're not. So we are currently in the United States, which has got to be one of the largest per percentage of GDP spent on space exploration. NASA's budget is less than 0.5% of the overall federal budget. So every tax dollar that gets collected, we spend less than 0.5 penny on space exploration. That's NASA's entire budget. That's not just the space station and, you know, the Dragon and the Falcon 9 rockets and the Starliner and all that, but it's also the Webb Space Telescope and all the rovers that Tanya talked about on Mars. You get all of that. I feel like I'm doing a sales pitch here, but you get all of that for half a penny of your tax dollar, right? So I think at that level of expenditure, it's wholly justified because it's a investment in our future. It's an investment for not only in our future as a species, as hopefully a spacefaring future, but it's an investment in future economies in space. It's an investment in education and science. So the return on that investment, I think, is definitely justifies that small level of expense.
And we see so much technology that comes out of space that's directly applicable to stuff we use today. I mean, the technology that we're doing to conduct this interview, there's so much of it you could tie to space. And looking a little bit broader than that, you know, the technology that we're using right now on the Perseverance rover as a test to generate breathable oxygen for astronauts in the future is carbon capture technology. It's the exact same tech we want to use on Earth to try to combat climate change. To be able to survive long-term in places like space stations and the moon and Mars, we need to learn to live more sustainably in even the most mundane of ways. Like, how do we make food packaging that isn't so wasteful? Thinking about that in terms of space gives you a much more creative playing field for your brain to work in than thinking, how can I make a chip bag that doesn't just rot away in a landfill? And you have a lot of people that get inspired by space, but don't necessarily go on to do that as their career, but they use that as a springboard for something else. Like, I spent 15 years of my career working on Mars and then ended up working at an Earth observation satellite company who had a goal to try to help understand many things, but some of them, things like the impact of global conflict on the agriculture sector and food security around the world. And I remember working on that specifically both during COVID and during the early days of the Ukraine war and thinking this is not a space that I ever would have expected to be in as a Mars scientist a few years ago. But using the skills I learned from that and the inspiration for space, I was able to take that and put it into a career that had very direct benefits to life here on Earth today.
Well, I think it's very interesting. I think as we get into the science fiction portion of this discussion is the impact that Apollo, as Tanya just mentioned now, especially the Apollo program, when we first sent people to the moon, the impact it had on many of us is incredible. as far as how formative it was. So for me, I could tell you that watching those films of Apollo astronauts walking around on the moon, I was less than 1 year old when Neil and Buzz took that first stroll. So I didn't see it live, but I watched it on videotape over and over. And that definitely encouraged me to become an engineer and then eventually to become an astronaut. But I could tell you it also inspired Elon Musk. And a lot of the stuff he's doing today with SpaceX is really because of what he felt was kind of the unfulfilled promise of Apollo, which is that, hey, we went to the moon in such a short period of time, made all these incredible advances. People extrapolated from there and thought that, well, certainly, you know, in another 10 years, we'll be on Mars. And that never happened. And so that kind of inspired him to kind of try to restart those fires and get us going again. And interestingly enough, the same inspiration struck Ron D. Moore, who was the creator of, or one of the co-creators of For All Mankind and Battlestar Galactica. But we had this very interesting conversation early on where he felt the same way, that like, hey, what if Apollo went differently? What if it kept going? Where would we be today? And he created a whole TV show about that. So Apollo, it was the source of inspiration for all of us. I mean, you could become a planetary scientist, an astronaut. You could create a space company or a TV show about space. But it's amazing the power, that inspiration, how each of these individuals were completely affected by it.
That artistic impact, I think, is really cool to point out, too, because it's not all about science and technology and engineering, right? The fact that people have written songs about this kind of stuff, that they've created television shows, that's really, really cool and culturally impactful in ways that you might not immediately think of when you think about the broader impact of the Apollo program.
You mentioned those the sci-fi details there. Let's get into those. Let's get into the logistics of what we would have to do to build an outpost on Mars. So Garrett, in For All Mankind, obviously by the fourth season, history has progressed in a way that means it's quite easy for people to get to Mars in the course of the show. Obviously, that is not the case for us. With today's technologies, how long would it take kind of the first people to get to Mars? And what would that journey be like? How would that compare to your own journeys, you know, from to and from the ISS, say?
Yeah, and by the fourth season of our show, we have nuclear fusion, we have plasma propulsion, so we kind of cheat a lot. I think we got a little too far ahead of ourselves with that, a lot of that stuff. But yeah, now we can ignore launch windows and just go whenever we want. And that's not really apropos to today, right? Today, we have to be very careful about when we leave for Mars. We have a window approximately once every 2 years when it's possible to take a large amount of payload to Mars, something like a human mission or a rover or something like that. And it takes time. It takes, you know, the best estimates are, you know, about almost a year, maybe 8 months or so, depending on exactly where in the pork chop plot you are when the planets align and it's time to go. But it'll take a while to get there. And then once you get there, you can't just like plant the flag like we did with Apollo and turn around and come home, because you have to wait for the launch window to open up for your return trip. So you're looking at like about a 2.5 year journey from start to finish. And that is not only difficult from just a duration, we've never had anybody stay in space for that long. The longest we've had is a Russian cosmonaut that was up there for a little bit over a year. And we have a couple of Americans that just barely crested a year. 2.5 would obviously be a big step. But more importantly, can we keep them healthy outside of the protection of the Earth's magnetic field, especially with regard to the radiation? Can we bring them there and go there and come home and not permanently damage those or injure those astronauts? So there's a lot of open questions, I guess.
Yeah, the question of radiation is really interesting. How could we begin to protect people from the radiation in a kind of theoretical Mars base? Does that affect, you know, the location, the design of a Mars base? You know, what could we do to help in that regard?
So the way we depict it in the show is something that I've had several conversations with our writers and producers about, that because I think that's the thing we took the most liberties with, is that if you couldn't just live for, we've had a character by the end of the fourth season that's been up there on Mars for years, living inside an aluminum habitat with, you know, some moderate shielding. And in reality, as I jokingly say, that, you know, he'd be glowing in the dark by now. So you know, we would have to, for protection from radiation, you really have only a couple choices. It's very difficult to shield for the galactic cosmic radiation that's out there. When we fly on on the space shuttle back in the day and on the space station today and Dragon and these other vehicles, we are above all the atmosphere, but we're only a couple hundred kilometers up, you know, about 280 kilometers up. And at that point, we're above the atmosphere, but we're below the Earth's magnetic field. And that gives us a lot of the same protection that we enjoy down here at the surface. And so even though when I spent about 3 months up on the space station, I took a larger dose of radiation than if I would have stayed home, it wasn't that bad. I mean, chest x-rays on that order of magnitude. But once you go and leave that protective magnetic field of the Earth and you go back to the moon or especially onto Mars, then you're fully exposed to not only galactic cosmic radiation, but also solar storms that can create SPEs, these solar proton or particle events. And that stuff can be really nasty. And there's a limited amount that you can do on the vehicles while you're in transit to shield yourself from those. You could create a safe haven by having like some water in the walls, and you could like get into the storm shelter if there's a solar storm. You can do that. But there's not much you could do about the galactic cosmic radiation until you get to the planet. And then you could go underground. And that's probably the best way to protect yourself on the planet is either by living inside a lava tube or by heaping a lot of the regolith, the Martian dirt. You need, I think, on the order of 3 or 4 meters to really get to a safe level of protection. But the problem is that nobody wants to create a TV show where everybody's living like a mole underground. So that wasn't an option for us. But that's in reality, I think that might be the best option.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Now, you touched on the Martian regolith there. That's another huge obstacle, right, to living on Mars. It's growing things on Mars. Tanya, how would we go about even the beginnings of growing food? Would all our food need to be similar to how it is on the ISS? Would we need to bring that food with us? What do we have to do to, you know, have the beginnings of a sort of self-sustaining agriculture on Mars?
This is a huge open question because, you know, on the space station, you're being constantly resupplied by stuff from the Earth because it's easy to get there, but that's not very practical for Mars. And you need to make sure that people are getting enough calories, they're getting enough nutrients, they're not, you know, getting hangry because they're getting tired of eating essentially MREs all the time. And so, you know, a lot of the initial conversations go toward things like, well, we could do hydroponics or aeroponics, but that really limits the availability of what you can grow because we can't grow everything through those methods. So, you know, what kind of technology can we develop in innovation for agriculture where maybe we can grow more things in using those approaches than we can do today? Can we do more with things like lab-grown meat or other lab-grown substitutes where you can make sure you're getting enough protein in your diet so that you're keeping up muscle mass, which is already going to be harder living in a lower gravity environment like Mars compared to being on the Earth, at least for early humans that, you know, don't grow up developing in that environment, which is like a whole nother issue. But in terms of the regolith that's actually there, you might be able to, you know, decontaminate it from some of the stuff that's in it, like perchlorates, which are particularly nasty. You don't want that ingested as a human. It inhibits the uptake of iodine by your thyroid, and that leads to some pretty bad health impacts. And everywhere we've landed on Mars, we've pretty much found perchlorates. So it seems to be pervasive. And then you might end up taking basically the Matt Damon approach in The Martian and using different types of fertilizers to try to implant some of the material that you need into the regolith to make it something where you could actually grow food in it, because there's just not really any notable amount of organic material or the other types of stuff you would need to just kind of set up shop and grow food like you could here on the Earth.
Tanya, I have a follow-up question for you on that, if I could, because this came up in discussion a while back. The Matt Damon did take a relatively homegrown approach, I guess I would say, to that fertilizer problem. But in reality, if we were to have large-scale agriculture on Mars and we're using Martian soil, maybe treated by spraying some kind of enzymes or something to get rid of the perchlorates. But if you did do that, would you still need some form of nutrients or, you know, some nitrogen or phosphates or something in the Earth's soil that is missing on Mars that even with some creative Matt Damon poop still would be missing? In other words, to do large scale farming on Mars, would you have to have a continuous supply of Earth dirt or at least chemicals that are in the Earth's dirt?
I think so, because if I recall correctly, the lack of phosphate is one particular issue on Mars. And we've found phosphates from orbit, like the spectral signature of phosphates, but they're not super widespread from what we've seen. I would say as a geologist rather than a farmer, I don't know exactly all the chemicals that we would be missing, but I do know that Mars is missing a lot of the key ingredients that we would want to be able to do large-scale agriculture today.
So it's looking pretty tricky so far. Another big question is water. How are we going to get enough water? It's my understanding that there's a certain amount of water ice on Mars. Is that correct, Tanya? Is that something we could exploit?
Yeah, I think water is actually maybe the least of our problems on Mars. There's a ton of water in the northern polar cap. It's mostly made up of water ice, but there's also a ton of buried ice in the higher latitudes in the northern hemisphere. It goes down to about around 40 degrees latitude. You start to see ice at depths where it could be excavated by an astronaut. So in terms of picking human landing sites, you know, there were a few years ago, SpaceX ran a series of landing site workshops where they kind of called in a bunch of Mars scientists and they were like, hey, help us pick the best places to land humans. And all the things that ended up in sort of that top categories list that we were all suggesting were places where the ice is easily accessible, not in the polar regions because the weather there is terrible, not a great place to live. But in those middle latitudes, the ice is accessible and the weather is slightly better. Unfortunately, the ice is also in very geographically boring regions. So kind of like taking liberties for the show to make, you know, a little bit snazzier looking habitats. I feel like it would be so heartbreaking to make the journey to go all the way to Mars. And then you're setting up shop in, you know, these flat, broad plains of a place like Arcadia Planitia, where, yeah, the ice is there, but there's not a whole lot else for you to look at.
Yeah, God, can you imagine? Wouldn't be the most exciting vista to see out of your lab window. Okay, so we've got a location. We have water. Food, we're a little less sure on, but let's gloss over that for now. Another issue, and you touched on it there, Tanya, would be the weather on Mars and the temperatures. The big obvious stuff that people worry about is stuff like dust storms. When you're talking about building a base on Mars, how do you protect that? And how do you protect our technology from that kind of Martian dust?
I mean, the way we do it right now is kind of based on picking those landing sites. The lucky thing for us is that the weather on Mars is extremely repeatable year over year, thanks to not having oceans or humans in the way to really affect things. So we know pretty well like where the dust storms happen and when they happen year after year, kind of like knowing when hurricane season is in North America or when tornadoes are going to come through the Midwest. You don't necessarily know how bad it's going to be each year, but you know kind of when that stuff's going to happen, so you can keep an eye out for it. So when we pick things like landing sites for the rovers, we don't want to send them to places where they're in the middle of a storm track. The same thing would certainly be true for a human base. Like we're probably not going to stick it in the middle of, like there's two main storm tracks, Acidalia and Utopia. Unfortunately, the Utopia storm track also really aligns with some subsurface ice that would be accessible. So that's a little bit tricky. But yeah, basically just being proactive about where you're selecting it based on where storms happen. The issue isn't so much that the wind itself is a problem. Again, kind of referencing the Martian here, like not really a spoiler for anybody that hasn't seen it because it's right at the beginning, but you know, the wind kicks up an antenna and blasts Mark Watney with it. The wind on Mars doesn't have enough oomph behind it to do any of that. So really it's just the fact that you have a ton of dust in the air that's kind of like the consistency of talcum powder. And so once you've shaken that all up in a storm, it takes a really long time for that to settle out of the air. And so when it's between, say, your solar panels and the sun, it's blocking a lot of the photons from getting to the solar panels to generate power. And then it also has a lot of basically like electromagnetic stickiness. And so it likes to get adhered to stuff really well. This was also a huge problem on the moon, sticking to things like joints in the spacesuits and just kind of eating through that material. We don't have a lot of good information on how long-term the dust impacts certain aspects of the rovers, just because it's kind of hard to look at that from being on the rover itself with the instruments that we have. But it's another big outstanding question of how hard is that dust going to be on a habitat? How are you going to keep that dust from getting into air filters? How is it going to impact the spacesuit design that you're going to need to have for Mars for humans to go outside? The dust seems so innocuous, but it's actually a really tricky thing to deal with.
It can also cause allergic reactions on the part of the crew if they inhale it. And, you can get pulmonary diseases potentially over, we don't really know what it does over long periods of time. So there are health risks as well as the risk to, it can get into bearings and it can get on seals and cause leaks of pressure. So there's, the dust can be a problem, but it's not like The Martian. It's not the way we depict it in movies all the time is like this massive squall that comes through and destroys everything. And the Martian air is so thin, even though the velocities can be high, the dynamic pressure, the force it produces of the wind is very, very small. So nothing's going to be knocked off the roof or anything, as Tanya pointed out.
So talking about health and keeping astronauts healthy, we obviously know that the microgravity that you experience in space has an effect on things like bone density. Do we know much about the kind of gravity that would be experienced on Mars and how that might affect people? Obviously, in For All Mankind, we see that has an effect on certain characters. I won't give too many details to avoid spoiling it. But, Garrett, when you were preparing to be in space, obviously, this is something you had to think about. What do you think about it in the context of Mars?
Well, it's interesting in that we know very well how the human body reacts to being in 1G, Earth's gravity. We evolved here. We're specifically suited. Our organism is specifically adapted to this 1G environment. We know pretty well, and it's very interesting, what happens to this organism when you put it in a 0G environment and how we adapt to living in microgravity. We have a good number of data points. I'm one of them, but there's hundreds of them. And we still get surprised, by the way. We're still learning new things. We still find that new problems keep popping up, like we're having issues with eyesight now that we didn't really understand. We still don't really understand what's happening. And we didn't even notice it early on in the space program. Even things like thrombosis that we're finding, or interesting vascular flow that we didn't know about until we started doing ultrasound on space station astronauts. So what we know about living in zero gravity is still incomplete and in work, if you will. But we know absolutely nothing about anything in between. Okay, so we have tons of data at 1G. We have a decent amount of data at 0G, at 1/3, like on Mars, or 1/6, like on the moon. The only thing we have is we have 12 men that walked on the moon, and they spent just a couple days there. And the amount of data we got from that is so limited that it really doesn't tell us anything about any kind of long-term effects like bone loss. And so we don't have no idea if these processes are linear, if they're exponential. So if you're at 1/2 of a G, is it half as bad as being at 0G, or is it like 90% as bad as it? We have no clue. So that's what's going to be very interesting. And that's what we need to learn. And hopefully, as we start by going back to the moon, we'll get more data and see what happens when we have humans up there in 1/6 gravity. And then hopefully that we'll learn enough to inform our ideas about going to Mars.
So how do you even begin to sort of prepare a person to go into that environment when we know so little about it? I mean, Garrett, what did you do to prepare before you went on the ISS? And how would that differ for a completely unknown environment?
Well, I watched a lot of movies. no, just kidding. When I went up on the shuttle and the space station, I had a pretty good idea what to expect. And back in the early days, that was not the case. I remember once talking to John Glenn, and he told us these great stories about when, before his first flight, sure, they had sent a few chimpanzees, and Yuri Gagarin had already done his flight. So there was some confidence, but they still really had no clue. And he said that some of the NASA physicians were telling him that, hey, when you go up in space, we're not really sure you're going to be, you might go blind because the eyeball might deform without gravity, change shape, and you might not be able to see anything. Okay. And then they said, well, and also, by the way, your heart might not work because without gravity, they kind of keep the air, the liquids and the gases separate. You might ingest some air into your cardiovascular system that could go to your heart and cause a cardiac arrest, and you might die. And he looked at them and he said, okay, well, I'll let you know when I get back. And it's going to be a little bit like that when we go on to back to the moon. And certainly if we go on to Mars, it's going to be like going back to those early days where we really don't have a good idea of what to expect. And some of it's going to be, well, we just have to be comfortable taking greater risks. And going back to our discussion about radiation, you know, when we say that right now, if you do that 2.5 year journey and you calculate how much radiation we expect you will receive, the dose equivalent that you will get, it exceeds our limits. So NASA right now has limits based on an OSHA requirement for radiation workers, which says that we don't want to have an excess probability of a radiation exposure induced death when you get back over the rest of your life more than 4%. So in other words, we don't want there to be a greater than 4% chance that over the rest of your life, after you get back to Earth, that you die of a cancer from the radiation that you would not have gotten otherwise. Okay. So that's the limit. And that's a pretty tight limit. Now, there's two problems with that. One is that based on our current projections, if you go to Mars and come back, you bust that limit. So either we got to get a little bit more risk tolerant and say, you know what, we're going to go to more than 4%. Or the other thing about this is we know exactly what kind of radiation is up there. We know exactly how many ions and how many electron volts each of these pieces of ionizing radiation. We know the flux. We know all this information about what's up there. We've sent instruments on our Mars probes that have measured all this stuff very, very carefully. What we don't know is what does that stuff do to human tissue particularly well, because no humans have been exposed to that kind of radiation. And the type of the data that we do have is a different type of radiation that people have been exposed to here on Earth and from a variety of different sources. So what we have done is we've just been conservative about saying, okay, if we have this amount of dose, this is what we think it does to humans. And we have a fudge factor that we put into the calculations, and we just kind of crank that thing up and say, okay, hopefully it's no worse than this. But we don't really know. And so either we got to be willing to accept greater risk, or we have to be able to sharpen our pencils and learn what this really does to people. And maybe it's not as bad. I'm hoping that it's not as bad as we think, but only time will tell. Right now we don't have that information.
So another big unknown, probably the biggest unknown, would be the prospect of finding any kind of life on Mars today. And Tanya, you touched on the kind of ancient life that could have once been on Mars earlier. What would happen if we were to discover, you know, an alien form of life on Mars? I know that's a pretty big question. That would obviously have potential effects on humans coming into contact with it. Would that be of particular concern to people?
I think for the scientific community, absolutely. There's a lot of really strict, what we call planetary protection rules around what most people would think of as sort of Andromeda strain, like, oh, we don't want to infect the Earth with alien microbes. But really, it's more about we don't want to infect alien worlds with Earth microbes. And if we're trying to definitively answer that question of whether if we find microbial life on Mars, is it something native to Mars or something that hitched a ride with us, that contamination question is going to be extremely important. We certainly don't want to introduce something that kills off local life before we have a chance to discover it. And we also don't want to bring something that maybe gets to Mars and mutates just enough that it looks like something that we think is new, or, you know, we're really not able to definitively say for sure, did this hitch a ride with us or not? So, you know, when we have missions that are going somewhere where we think that it's an environment that life could survive, like one of these places where there might be flows of really salty liquid water on the surface today, they would have to abide by really, really strict sterilization procedures to make sure as much as we can that something doesn't hitch a ride there. But I mean, there have been experiments on the space station where you can stick things like tardigrades in the vacuum of space and they just go into their hibernation state. And then once they come back into an environment that's good for them, they wake right back up. So I've heard more than one person say there's probably dormant stuff that we've brought with us to Mars because it's just impossible to kill everything. Like Earth is literally infested with life. The question, though, of whether Mars today is a place where life as we know it is a place that something could really survive, in general, the answer is no. But because everywhere you look on Earth where there's even like the slightest hint of habitability, there's something that has uniquely evolved to take advantage of that environment, you could still have something like that on Mars. So maybe in these little tiny pockets of briny water, you've got some weird extremophiles, you know, bacteria that are made to survive in these extreme environments. Maybe they are still there, but we don't know because we haven't been able to go there with something like a rover yet. I think in terms of like a broader societal impact, my answer to that question would have been very different 10 years ago than it would be today. I'm worried that people are so distracted with all the things happening in the world and attention spans are so small that finding microbial life will be a blip and then just kind of fall into the noise. I'm not sure it would have the impact that it would like we had in the 90s when there was these thoughts with this Martian meteorite they found in Antarctica that maybe there were microfossils in it to the level that Bill Clinton gave a speech about it. And you know, scientists analyzed this more, determined now these aren't actually microfossils. This is something geology can leave behind. But that spurred the creation of the field of astrobiology really as a whole. Like, how does life survive? Where does it come from? I'm not sure we would get that same kind of attention again. If we get the Vulcans showing up and like it's a recognizable thing that's alive, it could shake our hand, I think that's a different story. But I would hope even if we found microbes on Mars, like that is such a massive discovery and like helps put humans in the context of the universe, I would hope that people understand how big of a discovery that is, despite everything and our attention spans today.
Beth, I completely agree with Tanya. I think, you know, if we did find definitive proof of some kind of extraterrestrial life and it was microbial or virus or bacteria, I think people like Tanya and myself would completely, it would be a total freak out. You know, we would be, we'd be so excited and it'd be literally an earth-shattering event for us. But I agree that it might not be that impactful for their humanity, the rest of humanity, right? The ordinary person out there in the street, they might be like, oh yeah, that's nice. Hey, what are the Kardashians up to today? And then move on. And because I think we have prepared them so well, I think the bigger surprise would be that we never find some form of life elsewhere in the solar system or the universe. I think that would be almost more surprising than if we do find it. I think it's almost taken as a given, largely due to science fiction and also due to scientific studies that keep showing tantalizingly closer and closer clues that it actually does exist. But I think from a scientific perspective, the other interesting thing is even if we do find life on Mars, for example, as Tanya pointed out, we might have put it there ourselves. It might have been our trash, you know, or it might be all Matt Damon's fault. that he made a mess of the place and littered it with, you know, organisms. So how do we know that this thing we find, that we didn't bring it ourselves? Or even, you know, we know that Mars and Earth share little pieces of rock because we have found pieces of Mars on Earth, like that Mars meteorite that Tanya pointed out. But also it can go the other way where pieces of Earth might end up. So if we find a Martian, how do we know it's not an Earthling? How do we know that it wasn't some Earth meteor from, you know, many, many, many years ago that ended up on Mars bringing organic material with it? So how do we actually find conclusive proof that this is basically a second genesis, that this life is completely independent of life that came up on Earth? And that's a very tricky question that a lot of astrobiologists are really wrestling with right now. How do we know for sure?
You both sound quite frustrated, and I quite agree, I should emphasize. You sound quite frustrated by people's attitudes towards space. We don't really have the same sense of wonder that we once had about space, although obviously some people do. What is it that you think is the kind of biggest obstacle there? Like, is that an obstacle that could prevent us from ever reaching these, you know, grand heights? Do you think our general disinterest, or perhaps the kind of tumultuous times that we happen to be living in, do you think that might put the kibosh on us ever reaching Mars?
I think Garrett kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of sci-fi preparing everybody for this. People take it for granted now in a way that they didn't maybe even just 10 years ago. You know, SpaceX wasn't launching and landing rockets constantly streaming on the internet for everybody to see. And now I get routine questions in talks and interviews from adults who ask, have you ever been to Mars? Like completely seriously, because they don't even know that humans haven't been to Mars yet. Like they think The Martian was a documentary. And, you know, for space people, that might sound ridiculous. But for somebody that isn't paying attention to this kind of stuff on a day-to-day basis, it's easy for that to just kind of fall into the background. And so maybe we're kind of victims of our own success. Like, space is doing so well. People are launching to the space station so often. People probably can't name who's on the space station right now. I don't know who's up there right now. And I work in this stuff. I feel like ashamed to admit that. But there's been people there constantly for 25 years. So 25 plus years now. So it's easy to just kind of be like, oh yeah, there's stuff happening on the space station right now in a way that you couldn't do even just a few years ago, which I think is a little bit more optimistic than the take of, well, yes, and also the world is on fire right now. So space is a very low priority on a lot of people's brains. But people still seem to have a sense of wonder about it. Like, when I tell somebody what I do, if I'm in an Uber or like getting a haircut or something like that, the reaction is never like, oh, cool. They launch in to start asking questions about black holes or if we found life on Mars or, you know, if you could go to space, would you go? They always want to ask questions. And so, like, hiding underneath the hood, like, people still are really interested in this stuff. But there's a lot of other things going on, like, vying for that attention.
I'm a bit of an optimist on this point, in the sense that, you know, I was an astronaut during the shuttle program and the ISS, and I saw, you know, there was always a continuing interest in space by a certain segment of the population, even if it's not capturing the general population as it used to during Apollo. But I think it's because of the success of Apollo and the advancements that were happening so rapidly that it did capture the public imagination. We went from, you know, when President Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they were easy, but because they are hard, right? When he said that, you know how much time Americans had logged in space at that moment? 15 minutes and 22 seconds.
Wow.
Was the total log time of Americans in space. And that was Alan Shepard's one, you know, suborbital flight. So less than 10 years later, we got Neil and Buzz walking on the moon. So yes, that kind of progress is going to be dramatic, and it's going to be very, very hard to live up to that promise that it set, which again sparked, the TV show is the driving force behind SpaceX. I mean, it was amazing. But here's the thing that makes me optimistic, which is now that we do have this new, where we're in the post-shuttle era, where we have, you know, the Falcon 9 and the Dragon. Soon, hopefully, Boeing will have Starliner. We have Orion. We have the Artemis program going back to the moon. We have the James Webb telescope. We have Blue Origin with their new Glenn rocket that's about to come online. We got Starship. Oh, my God. Talk about a total game changer. So we have all this stuff going on, and I'm seeing a giant resurgence of interest in space compared to where we were during the shuttle era. And then the number of people that tune into those webcasts to watch Starship give it a shot and blow up in spectacular fashion, you know, the viewership is tremendous. The interest we have today in space, I think, is higher than at any point really during my lifetime. And so I think I'm not pessimistic about people's interest in this stuff. I'm seeing a lot of good things happening.
And if we take a more global perspective too, the Indian launch for their lunar rover recently, I can't remember the exact number, but I remember tuning into YouTube and thinking, this is the highest number I've ever seen for the number of people tuned into a live stream for a launch. And the whole chat was just people that were so excited, like, go India, we're so proud, can't wait to see this rover on the surface. So these new countries that are, you know, just getting into the game of lunar rovers and, you know, the UAE going to Mars, which I guess was more than a few years ago at this point, but new relative to the stage of how long NASA and Russia have been sending things into space. Like, you're seeing a lot of enthusiasm from those countries, and that's really, really refreshing to see. Like, more people are involved in space now than ever before.
So let's say that rapid progress you were talking about happens. Let's say it's so rapid that tomorrow someone gives you a call and says, would you like to go to Mars? Would you go to Mars?
Well, well, see, one of the main problems I have with that is that at least right now, there's no pizza on Mars. So I might not be the first one. And I actually had this conversation with my family, you know, and that's the other thing is I have a family now. So I think if we could all go, so this is not a simple answer to your simple question, but if you said, hey, you could bring your family, you can all go and live on Mars and we're confident we could do it safely, then I think, you know, the answer would be yes. But there's a couple strings attached, or caveats, I guess.
Like, idealistically, I would love to go to Mars and like walk up to see the rovers sitting in place on the surface and be like, you're here. Like, I worked on you and now you're here. This is so cool. But realistically, I'm terrified of flying. And so I don't think I would ever go to space.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think you're crazy, Garrett, for what you're doing. Oh my God, what you've done. that's not a life for me.
You're a brave man.
Yes, very brave man.
I understand where you're coming from. My mom is scared of flying. So she had a really hard time with what I decided to do as a career. And I had to overcome that, actually. It wasn't easy. So the likelihood of me actually doing all these things was actually relatively low, but it all worked out.
Tanya, Garrett, thank you so much. What an amazing discussion. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
That was TV columnist Bethan Ackerley in conversation with astronaut Garrett Reichsman and planetary scientist Tanya Harrison. If you've been watching For All Mankind, might I recommend Bethan's review of season 4? That's on our site at newscientist.com/podcasts. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it. Plus, our weekly news podcast and the delightfully diverting Escape Pod, they all drop right here every Friday and Tuesday. Find more journalism from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.